Hi, Dave Emery here. Side two of For the Record program number 792. Caution, Banksters at Work, subtitled More Collateralized Death Obligations. This has been recorded on May 11th of the year 2014. This is Mother's Day, so I guess one could say Happy Mother's Day. We've been looking at some mothers, so to speak, in the financial industry. We began by taking a look at an article from Bloomberg News in which we heard experts on the financial industry cautioning that none of these too-big-to-fail institutions should be investigated or brought to heel for their apparent criminal activity because that could create a loss of confidence and they were too big to fail and there would be all sorts of unfortunate fallout. And we have been looking at some other types of apparent fallout from some of the ongoing investigations into the wrongdoings of the financial industry. We've been taking a look at a lot of executives in the financial business who have died under very strange circumstances. A disproportionately large number of those, by the way, have had to do with J.P. Morgan. In For the Record 772, titled Collateralized Death Obligations, we took a look at the deaths of a number of people, including Gabriel McGee, who committed suicide, unquote, in London. We've also taken a look at Ryan Henry Crane from J.P. Morgan, who died at the ripe old age of 37. Toxicology tests are pending. Li Junji, a 33-year-old banker in Hong Kong, jumped from the roof of the J.P. Morgan headquarters in that city as well. Kenneth Belando, 28, a trader at Levy Capital, formerly an investment banking analyst at J.P. Morgan, jumped to his death from his sixth-floor apartment. In For the Record 772, we took a look at Richard Talley. He was the guy who supposedly killed himself by shooting himself 7 or 8 times in the head and torso with a nail gun. That's one of the worst cases of, quote, suicide, unquote, I've ever noticed. He had previously or ever come across. He previously had worked for Drexel Burnham Lambert. That was one of the companies that went down because of its involvement in criminal activity. And we noted at the conclusion of the Bloomberg News article with which we began this program that among the reasons why financial industry analysts were cautioning that these criminal investigations should be handled very carefully, if not completely dispensed with, is that those criminal investigations have helped to bring down Drexel Burnham Lambert. They may have also brought down Richard Talley, and been one of the reasons that he was motivated to take his own life by shooting himself in the head and torso 7 or 8 times with a nail gun. In any event, we're going to continue to take a look at some of the apparent fallout, again, a different type of fallout from some of these financial institution investigations. Bear in mind that the U.S. attorney in New York, Sreet Bharara, it appears to be heading toward investigations of Credit Suisse and BNP Paribas, B-P-A-R-A-I-B-A-S in France. And we're going to take a look once again at J.P. Morgan Chase and Morgan Stanley. We concluded our discussion on side one by taking a look and set some detail at the death of Ryan Crane of J.P. Morgan Equities Trading at the ripe old age of 37. We also took a look at the death of John Ruiz, Morgan Stanley Municipal Debt Analyst. No cause of death was listed. He died suddenly. I would note that heart attacks are among the very easy things that one can synthesize in this day and age. Killing someone with what appears to be an apparent heart attack is a very, very easy thing to do. Now, once again, taking a look at John Ruiz. This from Bloomberg News of February 12th of 2014. Bear in mind that For the Record 772 was recorded on February 9th of 2014. This is a Bloomberg News story. John Ruiz, Morgan Stanley Municipal Debt Analyst, dies at 53. And skipping down in the story, we read, on credits like Jefferson County and Puerto Rico, he dug deep and got to all of the important credit aspects of our issuer base very quickly, unquote, J.R. McDermott, a Morgan Stanley managing director, said about Ruiz, according to The Bond Buyer. That is a blog, an industry blog. We're going to take a look now at Jefferson County, Alabama. That has apparently become something of a template for municipal bankruptcy cases. Now, bear in mind, this is what the late unfortunate John Ruiz was working on when he left us suddenly at the age of 53. This is from the New York Times of November 19th of 2013. That is about 3 months before John Ruiz died. It's called A Municipal Bankruptcy May Create a Template, unquote. It's by Mary Williams Walsh, and it reads in part as follows. Jefferson County, Alabama, which just became the first municipality to tap the public bond markets while bankrupt, will go to court on Wednesday to seek approval for its plan to exit bankruptcy by the end of this year. But there's a catch. Even if Jefferson County does emerge from bankruptcy soon, it will not fully sever its ties to the federal bankruptcy court in Birmingham, Alabama, for 40 years. The county's unusual exit plan, which could offer a possible template for other bankrupt municipalities, calls for the court to retain jurisdiction for the life of $1.8 billion in sewer revenue debt that it sold over the last few days. If the county falters at some point, even decades from now, the bankruptcy court is supposed to have the power to enforce rate increases to produce the cash needed to pay back the $1.8 billion on schedule with interest. It certainly looks to be something of an unusual state of affairs. Jefferson County was itself a sewer, as we're going to look at. And it's interesting to note that, again, John Ruiz was described as having, quote, dug deep and got to all of the important credit aspects of our issuer base very quickly. Morgan Stanley was helping to arrange to refinance the debt of Jefferson County. Now, about Jefferson County and its debt. We read now from the Business Insider of October 23rd, 2011. This is by someone who writes under the name of Bond Girl, G-I-R-L. It's titled, The Incredible Story of the Jefferson County Bankruptcy, One of the Greatest Financial Ripoffs of All Time. And what this involves is the fact that Jefferson County was a deeply corrupt institution, and that a number of financial institutions took advantage of the enormous corruption in that county. The article reads in part, since so many people read my post on Harrisburg, I figured that I might as well explain how Jefferson County's problems evolved. I consider this story to be old news. As with Harrisburg, however, some people mistakenly characterize Jefferson County's financial problems as a canary in the coal mine for the municipal bond market, which suggests that they still have no idea what transpired there or how long Jefferson County has been in financial distress. Portraying Jefferson County as a typical municipal credit is akin to portraying Enron as a typical corporate credit. With Jefferson County, various financial firms, but primarily J.P. Morgan, exploited an existing culture of corruption and made taxpayers the victims of one of the largest frauds in the history of the financial markets. Again, as noted here by, quote, Bond Girl, unquote, J.P. Morgan was the principal firm, although there were others, involved in exploiting what is described here as an existing culture of corruption again, and made taxpayers the victims of one of the largest frauds in the history of the financial markets. Now, I wonder to what extent that and perhaps other shady doings of J.P. Morgan may have had something to do with the untimely deaths of people like Ryan Crane, Gabriel McGee, Li Junji, and Kenneth Belando. I also wonder whether perhaps if, in fact, John Ruiz, who had worked for Morgan Stanley, had indeed dug deep and got to all of the important credit aspects, whether that perhaps resulted in John Ruiz having been literally dug deep, so to speak. And again, he died of undetermined causes, or at least unexplained causes, at the age of 53. Died suddenly. Another J.P. Morgan employee died under sort of ambiguous circumstances. He was killed, hit and killed, while riding as a long-distance cyclist. He was described as an expert cyclist, and witnesses were at something of a loss to explain why he had been hit. This is from the Columbus, Ohio Dispatch of March 24th of 2014. Veteran cyclist killed by minivan knew the dangers all too well. Unquote. This is by Bill Bush, B-U-S-H, just like in George Jeb Bush, no relation as far as I know. Skipping down in the story, the individual was named Joseph A. Giampapa, capital G-I-A-M-P-A-P-A. Skipping down, and you're going to hear for whom the late unfortunate Mr. Giampapa worked. On Saturday, Jeff Stevens of Worthington got a call from the scene of another accident. This time it was Giampapa who had been struck by a minivan and killed while bicycling north of Troy. Giampapa, 56, of the Northwest Side, was an accomplished long-distance cyclist and a corporate attorney for J.P. Morgan Chase in Columbus. He was a longtime resident of Victorian Village who had moved with his wife Thelma into a condominium near Dublin about 2 years ago. He was able to ride his bike thousands of miles in short periods of time and covered some of the most difficult terrain in biking, including the same alpine routes used in the Tour de France, his friends said yesterday. And skipping down, Giampapa's friends were at a loss about why he was hit. Again, he was hit by a minivan from the rear. It wasn't a blind turn, unquote, said David Roderick of Athens, who helped organize the 200-kilometer event from Springfield to Quincy to Troy and back that Giampapa was participating in. It wasn't on a hill, Roderick said. You could see riders for a very long distance, unquote. So again, it remains to be seen why Mr. Giampapa was killed. The driver was 78, perhaps age was involved. And toxicology, the driver, by the way, was not charged. It remains to be seen exactly why he hit Mr. Giampapa. I don't know. I have more questions than answers. I would not dismiss the possibility that perhaps something else had actually happened here. There was some sort of sophisticated toxin administered, and the driver hit Mr. Giampapa after he had already been overcome. Again, I don't know. I cannot say for sure if foul play was involved, but certainly from an actuarial standpoint, the mortality rate in the financial business is far too great, and a very large number of these deaths involved J.P. Morgan or something connected with that, or someone connected with that. I also want to stress, it looks pretty obvious that there is some skullduggery going on here, some treachery. I don't know who might actually be doing the killing, whether it's one institution, say the mafia, or Chinese triads, or Russian mafia, or a drug cartel, or the remarkable and deadly Borman Capital Network, about which we speak so often, or perhaps a combination of different criminal syndicates taking advantage of different financial institutions. But there is no way in hell that all of these deaths are to be taken at face value. In a number of programs, including, for the record, 530 and 536, we have taken a look at Liechtenstein. That is a country in Europe, an EU member. It basically is a lean mean money laundering machine. There are only 32,000 people in the entire country. And the main business in Liechtenstein, is money laundering. And remember, the royal family of Liechtenstein is connected to the House of Habsburg and the heirs to the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and through them to the Thyssen Financial Interest, that's capital T-H-Y-S-S-E-N as in Nancy, and some distant relatives, such as Martin Wachter of the royal family of Liechtenstein, are also linked up through the Aesop Trust to the Bank Al-Taqwa network, which is connected to the Muslim Brotherhood, and also to Al-Qaeda and the September 11th attacks. I would also note that Liechtenstein, perhaps not surprisingly in the context of all of this skullduggery, has been the focal point of some recent mortality as well. This also is from Bloomberg News of April 7th of 2014. It's by Jan Henrik Forster, capital F-O-E-R-S-T-E-R, and Raoul Verschuer, capital V-E-R-S-C-H-U-U-R. Liechtenstein banker shot dead in reported investment feud. A Liechtenstein banker was shot dead after a feud involving an investment fund, and police say they believe the alleged killer later committed suicide. The 48-year-old man was shot in the underground garage of a financial institution in Balzers at 7:30 a.m. local time, the Liechtenstein police said on their website today. Neither the victim nor the institution was identified in the police statement. The deceased was Jürgen Frick, that's F-R-I-C-K, CEO of Bank Frick & Company AG, according to Switzerland's Radio 1, which cited employees of his bank. The suspect, Jürgen, J-U-E-R-G-E-N, Hermann, capital H-E-R-M-A-N-N, fled the scene in a smart car with Liechtenstein license plates, according to police. The authorities later said Hermann appears to have committed suicide after they found the vehicle in Rugel, R-U-G-G-E-L-L, 25 kilometers north of Balzers, with his passport and a confession. Skipping down, the confession was very interesting. I wonder, just looking at this, if he had a passport, why would he have committed suicide and written a confession? The fact that he had a passport at least suggests the possibility that he was looking to take off. And I wonder whether perhaps he really committed the killing or whether perhaps he was disposed of as well. He was accusing Bank Frick of serious financial and legal malfeasance. He is now dead, as is the CEO of the bank, and the deceased, late unfortunate Jürgen Hermann, won't be telling whether or not he committed the killing, and he certainly will not be standing trial. Skipping down. Bank Frick & Company, founded in 1998, specializes in wealth management and investment advice. The firm managed about 3.5 billion Swiss francs of assets on behalf of clients at the end of 2012, according to its website. The company's chairman is Mario Frick, F-R-I-C-K, who was Prime Minister of Liechtenstein from 1993 to 2001. Bank Frick was previously partly owned by BELAG PSK Bank AG, the Austrian lender that almost collapsed because of its links with failed U.S. futures firm Refco Incorporated. Skipping down again, the Liechtenstein government and the country's financial market authority, quote, illegally destroyed my investment company, Hermann Finance, and its funds, depriving me of my livelihood, according to a website registered under the name Jürgen Hermann of Hermann Finance AG. So again, whether or not he actually did the killing remains to be seen. I would note that Mario Frick was prime minister. The chairman of the bank was prime minister of Liechtenstein up until 2001. And again, Liechtenstein is and subsidiary companies in it are implicated in the Bank Al-Taqwa scenario and through that, the 2001 attacks. This from the more suspicious deaths. From the Santa Rosa Press Democrat of April 10th of 2014, four indicted in Sonoma Valley Bank collapse by Paul Payne, reads in part, after a three-year investigation into the collapse of Sonoma Valley Bank, federal prosecutors announced fraud charges Thursday against two former bank executives, a Santa Rosa attorney, and a Marin County developer who became one of the bank's largest borrowers before its implosion. The bank's former CEO, Sean Cutting, 44, of Sonoma, and its chief loan officer, Brian Melland, 45, of Santa Rosa, were arrested Wednesday with developer Bijan, B-I-J-A-N, Majlesi, M-A-D-J-L-E-S-S-I, 58, of Mill Valley, and attorney David Lonich, 59, of Santa Rosa. And then, following up from the San Francisco Chronicle of May 6, 2014, article by Kate Williams, indicted developer found dead off Mount Tam Cliff. A Marin County man facing federal fraud charges was found dead Thursday after his car plummeted off a cliff in Marin County. Bijan Majlesi, 58, of Mill Valley, was found in the car about 1 p.m. that had dropped over a 400-foot embankment along Highway 1, just north of Panoramic Highway outside Mill Valley. So again, more fallout from the financial scandals. I wonder about the following two from the Huffington Post of April 10th of 2014. Jim Flaherty's cause of death was a heart attack, police say. Jim Flaherty's cause of death was a heart attack, according to police. Skipping down. Flaherty resigned as Canadian finance minister in March. And again, the autopsy report had not been completed when the police made that announcement. Certainly not conclusive, but again, when the finance minister of Canada resigns in March and dies of a heart attack shortly afterward, it raises questions. In the beginning of this program, we took a look at the rationale that legal investigations of financial institutions should not take place because they are too big to fail. On May 23rd of 1980, I recorded the first of the archive shows, Uncle Sam and the Swastika, with my then co-host, Mark Ortiz, who very capably assisted me with the on-air responsibilities. And on May 23rd of 1980, we concluded the program by noting the dangers of economic concentration. This is from Miscellaneous Archive Show M11 from May 23rd, 1980, Uncle Sam and the Swastika.
Before we conclude, in evaluating the forces that had led to the defeat of his group's efforts to bring about German reform, James Stuart Martin feared two things. First, he was afraid that the return to power of Hitler's industrialists would lead to a resurgence of Nazism in Germany. And more importantly, Martin noted that the same pattern of economic concentration that led to the ascendance of Hitler in Germany was already evident in the United States in 1950, and he expressed his fear that this concentration of power might lead to the rise of Nazism in this country. Martin concludes All Honorable Men by discussing the economics of fascism and his fears for both Germany and the U.S.
Dave and I are going to take turns reading you James Martin's conclusion in All Honorable Men. First, though, we'd like to remind you that we're reading a book written in 1950, and some of Martin's references to German Reconstruction date this text. However, we both feel that Martin's message about the dangers inherent in economic concentration is still as valid as ever.
Proceeding with the conclusion of All Honorable Men, James Stuart Martin writes, "After 2.5 years, I came back from Germany quite well aware that I had been wrestling with a buzzsaw. We had not been stopped in Germany by German business. We had been stopped in Germany by American business. The forces that had stopped us had operated from the United States, but had not operated in the open. We were not stopped by a law of Congress, by an executive order of the President, or even by a change of policy approved by the President or any member of his cabinet. In short, whatever it was that had stopped us was not the government, but it clearly had command of channels through which the government normally operates. The relative powerlessness of governments in the face of growing economic power is, of course, not new. Between the two world wars, the outstanding development in world economics was the division of territories and markets, a private agreement among the largest corporations of Britain, Germany, and the United States, with minor participations by their counterparts in France, Italy, and Japan. National governments stood on the sidelines while bigger operators arranged the world's affairs.
We have the same difficulty today. What we need is to be able to have a government that controls economic power instead of becoming its tool. Since power is a public trust, including economic power, the first job of a government is to see that the power is used in the public interest and not against it. By chartering a private corporation, a government delegates to the corporate body some of its own power to regulate commerce. Strictly speaking, this is an abdication, by the government. It is time to view the results of this abdication by constitutional governments in favor of private governments. The occupation of Germany has already provided a good laboratory in which we could study the activities of self-centered corporations and the activities of a German national government in which these corporate combines had a dominant influence.
The eco-political masters of Germany boosted Hitler and his program into the driver's seat at a time when the tide in the political fight between the Nazis and the supporters of the Weimar Republic was swinging against the Nazis. All of the men who mattered in banking and industrial circles could quickly agree on one program and throw their financial weight behind it. Their support won the election for the Nazis. We must assume that the same thing is not yet true in the United States. We do have economic power so concentrated that it would lie in the power of a group of not more than 100 men, if they could agree among themselves, to throw the same kind of combined economic weight behind a single program. They have not agreed yet. There are still enough divisions within the Republican Party and enough minor differences between Republicans and Democrats to indicate that on some fundamental economic questions, there are different points of view, each one championed by a different faction inside the financial and industrial community itself. If the United States should run into serious economic difficulties, however, most of the conditions for a reenactment of the German drama would already exist on the American stage. The slight differences within the camp of the fraternity then may be the only real barrier to the kind of integration of the financial and industrial community behind a single repressive program like that which the financiers and industrialists of Germany executed through Hitler. Are we safe in assuming that it would take a grave economic crisis to precipitate the dangers inherent in economic concentration? The basic integration of the financial and industrial groups in the United States is evident when we look at the increase of concentration in the past few years.
Our job now, then, is to prepare for a future crisis before it happens. This means that in Germany we must have a double objective. The occupation of Germany must be put back on the track. But more than that, we have to reassert public goals in the United States, which will prevent the already apparent concentration of economic power in our own country from reaching the end it did in Germany. We cannot hope to deal with the concentration of economic power in Germany until we are able to deal with the concentration of economic power in the United States. This brings the German problem home with an urgency that has been missing in most post-war discussions about Germany. The need to treat Germany as an American problem was not felt in this country after World War I. Despite warnings from men whose experience with the German occupation had convinced them that we were entering a period of armed truce and not peace, business arrangements went ahead unchecked to rebuild a Germany that could not be expected to be anything but a steamroller. Now, with all that experience and warning behind us, and in spite of strong popular support for the reform of Germany, we have had to watch the same errors being repeated as if nothing else were possible. The moral of this is not that Germany is an inevitable menace, but that there are forces in our own country which can make Germany a menace. And more importantly, those forces could create a menace of their own here at home, not through a deliberate plot to bring about a political catastrophe, but as a calm judgment of business necessity. The men who might do this are not Nazis, but businessmen. Not criminals, but honorable men.
That again, the conclusion of Miscellaneous Archive Show M11, Uncle Sam and the Swastika for May 23rd of 1980. This concludes For the Record Program, Side 2 of For the Record Program number 792, Caution, Banksters at Work, subtitled More Collateralized Death Obligations. This has been recorded on May 11th of 2014. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.